experienced with women. She was the one to grab you first, and now you consider her to be the embodiment of femininity, he wrote Hans Albert. That is the well-known way that women take advantage of unworldly people. So he suggested that an attractive woman would remedy such problems. But Hans Albert was as stubborn as his father had been 25 years earlier, and he was determined to marry Frieda. Einstein conceded that he couldn't stop him, but he urged his son to promise not to have children. And should you ever feel like you have to leave her, you should not be too proud to come talk to me, Einstein wrote. After all, that day will come. Hans Albert and Frieda married in 1927, had children, and remained married until her death 31 years later. As Evelyn Einstein, their adopted daughter, recalled years later, Albert had such a hell of a time with his parents over his own marriage that you would think he would have had the sense not to interfere with his sons. But no, when my father went to marry my mother, there was explosion after explosion. Einstein expressed his dismay about Hans Albert's marriage in letters to Eduard. The deterioration of the race is a serious problem, Einstein wrote. That is why I cannot forgive Hans Albert his sin. I instinctively avoid meeting him because I cannot show him a happy face. But within 2 years, Einstein had begun to accept Frieda. The couple came to visit him in the summer of 1929, and he reported back to Eduard that he had made his peace. She made a better impression than I had feared, he wrote. He is really sweet with her. God bless those rose-colored spectacles. For his part, Eduard was becoming increasingly dreamy in his academic pursuits, and his psychological problems were becoming more apparent. He liked poetry and wrote doggerel and aphorisms that often had an edge to them, especially when the subject was his family. He played the piano, particularly Chopin, with a passion that was initially a welcome contrast to his usual lethargy, but eventually became scary. His letters to his father were equally intense, pouring out his soul about philosophy and the arts. Einstein responded sometimes tenderly and occasionally with detachment. I often sent my father rather rapturous letters, and several times got worried afterwards because he was of a cooler disposition, Eduard later recalled. I learned only a lot later how much he treasured them. Eduard went to Zurich University, where he studied medicine and planned to become a psychiatrist. He became interested in Sigmund Freud, whose picture he hung in his bedroom, and attempted his own self-analysis. His letters to his father during this period are filled with his efforts, often astute, to use Freud's theories to analyze various realms of life, including movies and music. Not surprisingly, Eduard was especially interested in relationships between fathers and sons. Sometimes his comments were simple and poignant. It's at times difficult to have such an important father because one feels so unimportant, he wrote at one point. A few months later, he poured out more insecurities. People who fill their time with intellectual work bring into the world sickly, nervous, and at times even completely idiotic children. For example, you, me. Later, his comments became more complex, such as when he analyzed his father's famous lament that fate had punished him for his contempt for authority by making him an authority himself. Eduard wrote, "This means, psychoanalytically, that because you didn't want to bend in front of your own father and instead fought with him, you had to become an authority in order to step into his place." Einstein met Freud when he came from Vienna to Berlin for New Year 1927. Freud, then 70, had cancer of the mouth and was deaf in one ear. But the two men had a pleasant talk, partly because they focused on politics rather than on their respective fields of study. "Einstein understands as much about psychology as I do about physics," Freud wrote to a friend. Einstein never asked Freud to meet or treat his son, nor did he seem impressed by the idea of psychoanalysis. "It may not always be helpful to delve into the subconscious," he once said. "Our legs are controlled by 100 different muscles. Do you think it would help us to walk if we analyzed our legs and knew the exact purpose of each muscle and the order in which they work?" He certainly never expressed any interest in undergoing therapy himself. "I should like very much to remain in the darkness of not having been analyzed," he declared. Eventually, however, he did concede to Eduard, perhaps to make him happy, that there might be some merit to Freud's work, I must admit that through various little personal experiences, I am convinced at least of his main theses. While at the university, Edward fell in love with an older woman, a trait that apparently ran in the family and might have amused Freud. When the relationship came to a painful conclusion, he fell into a listless depression. His father suggested he find a dalliance with a younger plaything. He also suggested that he find a job. Even a genius like Schopenhauer was crushed by unemployment, he wrote. Life is like riding a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving. Edward was unable to keep his balance. He began cutting classes and staying in his room. As he grew more troubled, Einstein's care and affection for him seemed to increase. There was a painful sweetness in his letters to his troubled son as he engaged with his ideas about psychology and wrestled with his enigmatic aphorisms. "There is no meaning to life outside of life itself," Edward declared in one of these aphorisms. Einstein replied politely that he could accept this, but that clarifies very little. Life for its own sake, Einstein went on, was hollow. People who live in a society, enjoy looking into each other's eyes, who share their troubles, who focus their efforts on what is important to them and find this joyful, these people lead a full life. There was a knowing self-referential quality in that exhortation. Einstein himself had little inclination or talent for sharing other people's troubles, and he compensated by focusing on what was important to him. "Tete really has a lot of myself in him, but with him it seems more pronounced," Einstein conceded to Marich. "He's an interesting fellow, but things won't be easy for him." Einstein visited Edward in October 1930, and together with Marich tried to deal with his downward mental spiral. They played piano together, but to no avail. Edward continued to slip into a darker realm. Soon after he left, the young man threatened to throw himself out of his bedroom window, but his mother restrained him. The complex strands of Einstein's family life came together in an odd scene in November 1930. 4 years earlier, a conniving Russian writer named Dmitry Marianov had sought to meet Einstein. With great nerve and tenacity, he presented himself at Einstein's apartment and was able to convince Elsa to let him in. There he proceeded to charm Einstein by talking about Russian theater, and also to turn the head of Elsa's daughter Margot by engaging in a grand show of handwriting analysis. Margot was so painfully shy that she often hid from strangers, but Marianov's wiles soon brought her out of her shell. Their wedding occurred a few days after Edward had tried to commit suicide, and a distraught Marich made an unannounced visit to Berlin to ask her former husband for help. Marianov later described the scene at the end of his wedding ceremony. "As we came down the steps, I noticed a woman standing near the portico. I would not have noticed her except that she looked at us with such an intensely burning gaze that it impressed me." Margot said under her breath, "It's Mileva." Einstein was shaken deeply by his son's illness. "This sorrow is eating up Albert," Elsa wrote. "He finds it difficult to cope with." There was, however, not much he could do. The morning after the wedding, he and Elsa left by train to Antwerp, from which they would sail for their second voyage to the United States. It was a hectic departure. Einstein got separated from Elsa at the Berlin station, then lost their train tickets. But eventually they got everything together and embarked on what would be another triumphal American visit. America again. Einstein's second trip to America, beginning in December 1930, was supposed to be different from his first. This time there would be no public frenzy or odd hoopla. Instead, he was coming for a 2-month working visit as a research fellow at the California Institute of Technology. The officials who arranged it were eager to protect his privacy, and like his friends in Germany, they viewed any publicity as undignified. As usual, Einstein seemed to agree, in theory. Once it was known that he was coming, he was swamped with dozens of telegrams each day with speaking offers and award invitations, all of which he declined. On the way over, he and his mathematical calculator, Walter Meyer, holed up, working on revisions to his unified field theory, in an upper-deck suite with a sailor guarding the door. He even decided that he would not disembark when his ship docked in New York. I hate facing cameras and having to answer a crossfire of questions, he claimed. Why popular fancies should seize on me, a scientist dealing in abstract things and happy if left alone, is a manifestation of mass psychology that is beyond me. But by then, the world, and especially America, had irrevocably entered the new age of celebrity. Aversion to fame was no longer considered natural. Publicity was still something that many proper people tended to avoid, but its lure had begun to be accepted. The day before his ship docked in New York, Einstein sent word that he had relented to reporters' requests and would hold a press conference and photo opportunity upon his arrival. It was worse than the most fantastic expectation, he recorded in his travel diary. 50 reporters plus 50 more cameramen swarmed aboard, accompanied by the German consul and his fat assistant. The reporters asked exquisitely inane questions, to which I replied with cheap jokes, which were enthusiastically received. Asked to define the fourth dimension in a word, Einstein replied, "You will have to ask a spiritualist." Could he define relativity in one sentence? It would take me 3 days to give a short definition. There was, however, one question that he tried to answer seriously, and which he, alas, got wrong. It was about a politician whose party had risen from obscurity 3 months earlier to win 18% of the vote in the German elections. "What do you think of Adolf Hitler?" Einstein replied, "He is living on the empty stomach of Germany. As soon as economic conditions improve, he will no longer be important." Time magazine that week featured Elsa on its cover, wearing a sprightly hat and exulting in her role as wife of the world's most famous scientist. The magazine reported, "Because mathematician Einstein cannot keep his bank account correctly, his wife had to balance his finances and handle the arrangements for the trip. All these things I must do so that he will think he is free," she told the magazine. "He is all my life. He is worth it. I like being Mrs. Einstein very much." One duty she assigned herself was to charge $1 for her husband's autograph and $5 for his photograph. She kept a ledger and donated the money to charities for children. Einstein changed his mind about staying secluded aboard ship while it was docked in New York. In fact, he seemed to pop up everywhere. He celebrated Hanukkah with 15,000 people in Madison Square Garden, toured Chinatown by car, lunched with the editorial board of the New York Times, was cheered when he arrived at the Metropolitan Opera to hear the sensational soprano Maria Yaritsa sing Carmen, received the keys to the city, which Mayor Jimmy Walker quipped were given relatively, and was introduced by the president of Columbia University as the ruling monarch of the mind. He also paid a visit to Riverside Church, a massive structure with a 2,100-seat nave, which had just been completed. It was a Baptist church, but above the west portal, carved in stone amid a dozen other great thinkers in history, was a full-length statue of Einstein. Harry Emerson Fosdick, the noted senior minister, met Einstein and Elsa at the door and gave them a tour. Einstein paused to admire a stained-glass window of Immanuel Kant in his garden, then asked about his own statue. "Am I the only living man among all these figures of the ages?" Dr. Fosdick, with a sense of gravity duly noted by the reporters present, replied, "That is true, Professor Einstein." "Then I will have to be very careful for the rest of my life as to what I do and say," Einstein answered. Afterward, according to an article in the Church Bulletin, he joked, "I might have imagined that they could make a Jewish saint of me, but I never thought I'd become a Protestant one." The church had been built with donations from John D. Rockefeller, Jr., and Einstein arranged to have a meeting with the great capitalist and philanthropist. The purpose was to discuss the complex restrictions that Rockefeller foundations were putting on research grants. "The red tape," Einstein said, "encases the mind like the hands of a mummy." They also discussed economics and social justice in light of the Great Depression. Einstein suggested that working hours be shortened, so that, at least in his understanding of economics, more people would have a chance to be employed. He also said that lengthening the school year would help keep young people out of the workforce. "Does not such an idea," Rockefeller asked, "impose an unwarranted restriction upon individual freedom?" Einstein replied that the current economic crisis justified measures like those taken during wartime. This gave Einstein the opportunity to propound his pacifist positions. which Rockefeller politely declined to share. His most memorable speech was a pacifist clarion call that he gave to the New History Society, in which he called for an uncompromising war resistance and refusal to do military service under any circumstances. Then he issued what became a famous call for a brave 2%. The timid might say, "What's the use? We shall be sent to prison." To them, I would reply, even if only 2% of those assigned to perform military service should announce their refusal to fight, governments would be powerless. They would not dare send such a large number of people to jail. The speech quickly became a manifesto for war resistors. Buttons that simply said 2% began sprouting on the lapels of students and pacifists. The pacifists assumed no other explanation was needed, but some contemporary accounts somehow thought the buttons referred to 2% beer. The New York Times headlined the story on page 1 and reprinted the speech in its entirety. One German paper also headlined it with less enthusiasm. Einstein begging for military service objectors, scientists' unbelievable publicity methods in America. On the day he left New York, Einstein revised slightly one of the statements he had made upon his arrival. Asked again about Hitler, he declared that if the Nazis were ever able to gain control, he would consider leaving Germany. Einstein's ship headed to California through the Panama Canal. While his wife spent time at the hairdresser, Einstein dictated letters to Helen Dukas and worked on unified field theory equations with Walter Meyer. Although he complained about the perpetual photographing he had to endure from his fellow passengers, he did let one young man sketch him, and then he appended his own self-deprecating doggerel to turn it into a collector's item. In Cuba, where he relished the warm weather, Einstein addressed the local Academy of Sciences. Then it was on to Panama, where a revolution was brewing that would depose a president who, it turned out, was also a graduate of the Zurich Polytechnic. That didn't stop officials from offering Einstein an elaborate welcome ceremony, at which he was presented a hat that an illiterate Ecuadorian Indian worked for 6 months weaving. On Christmas Day, he broadcast holiday greetings to America via the ship's radio. When his ship docked in San Diego on the last morning of 1930, dozens of newsmen clambered aboard, with two of them falling off the ladder as they rushed their way onto the deck. 500 uniformed girls stood on the dock, waiting to serenade him. The gaudy arrival ceremony lasted 4 hours, filled with speeches and presentations. Were there men, he was asked, living elsewhere in the universe? Other beings, perhaps, but not men, he answered. Did science and religion conflict? Not really, he said, though it depends, of course, on your religious views. Friends who saw all the arrival hoopla on newsreels back in Germany were astonished and somewhat appalled. "I am always very amused to see and hear you in the weekly newsreel," wrote the sharp-penned Hedwig Born, "being presented with a floral float containing lovely sea nymphs in San Diego, and that sort of thing. However crazy things must look from the outside, I always have the feeling that the dear Lord knows what he's up to." It was on this trip, as noted in the previous chapter, that Einstein visited the Mount Wilson Observatory, was shown evidence of the expanding universe, and renounced the cosmological constant he had added to his general relativity equations. He also paid tribute to the aging Albert Michelson, carefully praising his famous experiments that detected no ether drift, without explicitly saying that they were a basis for his special theory of relativity. Einstein soaked in a variety of the delights that Southern California could offer. He attended the Rose Bowl parade, was given a special screening of All Quiet on the Western Front, and sunbathed nude in the Mojave Desert while at a friend's house for the weekend. At a Hollywood studio, the special effects team filmed him pretending to drive a parked car, and then that evening amused him by showing how they made it seem as if he were zipping through Los Angeles, soaring up into the clouds, flying over the Rockies, and eventually landing in the German countryside. He even was offered some movie roles, which he politely declined. He went sailing in the Pacific with Robert A. Millikan, Caltech's president, who Einstein noted in his diary, plays the role of God at the university. Millikan was a physicist who had won the Nobel Prize in 1923 for, as the organization noted, having verified experimentally Einstein's all-important photoelectric equation. He likewise verified Einstein's interpretation of Brownian motion. So it was understandable that as he was building Caltech into one of the world's preeminent scientific institutions, he worked diligently to bring Einstein there. Despite all they had in common, Millikan and Einstein were different enough in their personal outlooks that they were destined to have an awkward relationship. Millikan was so conservative scientifically that he resisted Einstein's interpretation of the photoelectric effect and his dismissal of the ether, even after they were apparently verified by his own experiments. And he was even more conservative politically. A robust and athletic son of an Iowa preacher, he had a penchant for patriotic militarism that was as pronounced as Einstein's aversion to it. Moreover, Millikan was enhancing Caltech through hefty donations from like-minded conservatives. Einstein's pacifist and socialist sentiments unnerved many of them, and they urged Millikan to restrain him from making pronouncement on earthly rather than cosmic issues. As Major General Amos Fried put it, they must avoid aiding and abetting the teaching of treason to the youth of this country by being hosts to Dr. Albert Einstein. Millikan responded sympathetically by denouncing Einstein's call for military resistance and declaring that the 2% comment, if he ever made it, is one which no experienced man could possibly have made. Millikan particularly disdained the crusading writer and union advocate Upton Sinclair, whom he called the most dangerous man in California, and the actor Charlie Chaplin, who equaled Einstein in global celebrity and surpassed him in left-wing sentiments. Much to Millikan's dismay, Einstein promptly befriended both. Einstein had corresponded with Sinclair about their shared commitment to social justice, and upon arriving in California was happy to accept his invitations to a variety of dinners, parties, and meetings. He even remained polite, though amused, while attending a farcical séance at Sinclair's home. When Mrs. Sinclair challenged his views on science and spirituality, Elsa chided her for having such presumption. "You know, my husband has the greatest mind in the world," she said. Mrs. Sinclair responded, "Yes, I know, but surely he doesn't know everything." During a tour of Universal Studios, Einstein mentioned that he had always wanted to meet Charlie Chaplin. So the studio boss called him, and he came right over to join the Einsteins for lunch in the commissary. The result, a few days later, was one of the most memorable scenes in the new era of celebrity. Einstein and Chaplin arriving together dressed in black tie with Elsa beaming for the premiere of City Lights. As they were applauded on their way into the theater, Chaplin memorably and accurately noted, "They cheer me because they all understand me, and they cheer you because no one understands you." Einstein struck a more serious pose when he addressed the Caltech student body near the end of his stay. His sermon, grounded in his humanistic outlook, was on how science had not yet been harnessed to do more good than harm. During war, it gave people the means to poison and mutilate one another, and in peacetime it has made our lives hurried and uncertain. Instead of being a liberating force, it has enslaved men to machines by making them work long, wearisome hours, mostly without joy in their labor. Concern for making life better for ordinary humans must be the chief object of science. Never forget this when you are pondering over your diagrams and equations. The Einsteins took a train east across America for their return sail from New York. Along the way, they stopped at the Grand Canyon, where they were greeted by a contingent of Hopi Indians, employed by the concession stand at the canyon, though Einstein did not know that, who initiated him into their tribe as the Great Relative, and gave him a bountiful feathered headdress that resulted in some classic photographs. When his train reached Chicago, Einstein gave a speech from its rear platform to a rally of pacifists who had come to celebrate him. Millikan must have been appalled. It was similar to the 2% speech Einstein had given in New York. "The only way to be effective is through the revolutionary method of refusing military service," he declared. "Many who consider themselves good pacifists will not want to participate in such a radical form of pacifism. They will claim that patriotism prevents them from adopting such a policy. But in an emergency, such people cannot be counted on anyhow." Einstein's train pulled into New York City on the morning of March 1st, and for the next 16 hours, Einstein mania reached new heights. Einstein's personality, for no clear reason, triggers outbursts of a kind of mass hysteria, the German consul reported to Berlin. Einstein first went to his ship, where 400 members of the War Resisters League were waiting to greet him. He invited them all on board and addressed them in a ballroom. If, in time of peace, members of pacifist organizations are not ready to make sacrifices by opposing authorities at the risk of imprisonment, they will certainly fail in time of war, when only the most steeled and resolute person can be expected to resist. The crowd erupted in delirium, with overwrought pacifists rushing up to kiss his hand and touch his clothing. The socialist leader Norman Thomas was at the meeting, and he tried to convince Einstein that pacifism could not occur without radical economic reforms. Einstein disagreed. "It is easier to win over people to pacifism than to socialism," he said. "We should work first for pacifism, and only later for socialism." That afternoon, the Einsteins were taken to the Waldorf Hotel, where they had a sprawling suite in which they could meet a stream of visitors, such as Helen Keller and various journalists. Actually, it was two full suites connected by a grand private dining room. When one friend arrived that afternoon, he asked Elsa, "Where is Albert?" "I don't know," she replied with some exasperation. "He always gets lost somewhere in all these rooms." They finally found him wandering around trying to find his wife. The ostentatious spread annoyed him. "I'll tell you what to do," the friend suggested. "Lock the second suite off entirely, and you will feel better." Einstein did, and it worked. That evening he addressed a sold-out fundraising dinner on behalf of the Zionist cause, and he finally made it back to his ship just before midnight. But even then his day was not over. A large crowd of young pacifists, chanting "No War Forever," cheered him wildly as he reached the pier. They later formed the Youth Peace Federation, and Einstein sent them a scrawled message of encouragement. "I wish you great progress in the radicalization of pacifism." Einstein's pacifism. This radical pacifism had been building in Einstein throughout the 1920s. Even as he was retreating from the fore of physics, he was becoming, at age 50, more engaged in politics. His primary cause, at least until Adolf Hitler and his Nazis took power, was that of disarmament and resistance to war. "I am not only a pacifist," he told one interviewer on his trip to America, "I am a militant pacifist." He rejected the more modest approach taken by the League of Nations, the international organization formed after World War I, which the United States had declined to join. Instead of calling for complete disarmament, the League was nibbling at the margins by trying to define proper rules of engagement and arms control. When he was asked in January 1928 to attend one of the League's disarmament commissions, which was planning to study ways to limit gas warfare, he publicly proclaimed his disgust with such half-measures. "It seems to me an utterly futile task to prescribe rules and limitations for the conduct of war. War is not a game. Hence, one cannot wage war by rules as one would in playing games. Our fight must be against war itself. The masses of people can most effectively fight the institution of war by establishing an organization for the absolute refusal of military service." Thus he became one of the spiritual leaders of the growing movement led by War Resisters International. The international movement to refuse participation in any kind of war service is one of the most encouraging developments of our time, he wrote the London branch of that group in November 1928. Even as the Nazis began their rise to power, Einstein refused to admit, at least initially, that there might be exceptions to his pacifist postulate. "What would he do," a Czech journalist asked, "if another European war broke out and one side was clearly the aggressor? I would unconditionally refuse all war service, direct or indirect, and would seek to persuade my friends to adopt the same position, regardless of how I might feel about the causes of any particular war," he answered. The censors in Prague refused to allow the remark to be published, but it was made public elsewhere and enhanced Einstein's status as the standard-bearer of pacifist purists. Such sentiments were not unusual at the time. The First World War had shocked people by being so astonishingly brutal and apparently unnecessary. Among those who shared Einstein's pacifism were Upton Sinclair, Sigmund Freud, John Dewey, and H.G. Wells. "We believe that everybody who sincerely wants peace should demand the abolition of military training for youth," they declared in a 1930 manifesto, which Einstein signed. "Military training is the education of the mind and body in the technique of killing, It thwarts the growth of man's will for peace. Einstein's advocacy of war resistance reached its peak in 1932, the year before the Nazis seized power. That year, a general disarmament conference, organized by the League of Nations, plus the United States and Russia, convened in Geneva. Einstein initially had grand hopes that the conference, as he wrote in an article for The Nation, will be decisive for the fate of the present generation and the one to come. But he warned that it must not merely content itself with feckless arms limitation rules. Mere agreements to limit armaments confer no protection, he said. Instead, there should be an international body empowered to arbitrate disputes and enforce the peace. Compulsory arbitration must be supported by an executive force. His fears were realized. The conference became mired in such issues as how to calculate the offensive power of aircraft carriers in assessing an arms control balance. Einstein showed up in Geneva in May, just as that topic was being tackled. When he appeared in the visitors' gallery, the delegates stopped their discussions and rose to applaud him. But Einstein was not pleased. That afternoon he called a press conference at his hotel to denounce their timidity. One does not make war less likely to occur by formulating rules of warfare, he declared to dozens of excited journalists who abandoned the conference to cover his criticism. We should be standing on rooftops, all of us, and denouncing this conference as a travesty. He argued that it would be better for the conference to fail outright than to end with an agreement to humanize war, which he considered a tragic delusion. Einstein tended to become impractical once outside the scientific field, his novelist friend and fellow pacifist, Romain Rolland, commented. It is true that, given what was about to happen in Germany, disarmament was a chimera, and pacifist hopes were, to use a word sometimes flung at Einstein, naive. Yet it should be noted that there was some merit to his criticisms. The arms control acolytes in Geneva were no less naive. They spent 5 years in futile, arcane debates as Germany rearmed itself. Political ideals. Go one step further, Einstein, the headline exhorted. It was on an essay published in August 1931 as an open letter to Einstein by the German socialist leader Kurt Hiller, one of many activists on the left who urged Einstein to expand his pacifism into a more radical politics. Pacifism was only a partial step, Hiller argued. The real goal was to advocate socialist revolution. Einstein labeled the piece rather stupid. Pacifism did not require socialism, and socialist revolutions sometimes led to the suppression of freedom. I am not convinced that those who would gain power through revolutionary actions would act in accord with my ideals, he wrote to Hiller. I also believe that the fight for peace must be pushed energetically, far ahead of any efforts to bring about social reforms. Einstein's pacifism, world federalism, and aversion to nationalism were part of a political outlook that also included a passion for social justice, a sympathy for underdogs, an antipathy toward racism, and a predilection towards socialism. But during the 1930s, as in the past, his wariness of authority, his fealty to individualism, and his fondness for personal freedom made him resist the dogmas of Bolshevism and communism. Einstein was neither read nor dupe, writes Fred Jerome, who has analyzed both Einstein's politics and the large dossier of material gathered on him by the FBI. This wariness of authority reflected the most fundamental of all of Einstein's moral principles. Freedom and individualism are necessary for creativity and imagination to flourish. He had demonstrated this as an impertinent young thinker, and he proclaimed the principle clearly in 1931. I believe that the most important mission of the state is to protect the individual and to make it possible for him to develop into a creative personality, he said. Thomas Bucky, the son of a doctor who cared for Elsa's daughters, was 13 when he met Einstein in 1932, and they began what would become a long-standing discussion of politics. Einstein was a humanist, socialist, and a democrat, he recalled. He was completely anti-totalitarian, no matter whether it was Russian, German, or South American. He approved of a combination of capitalism and socialism, and he hated all dictatorships of the right or left. Einstein's skepticism about communism was evident when he was invited to the 1932 World Anti-War Congress. Though putatively a pacifist group, it had become a front for Soviet communists. The official call for the conference, for example, denounced the imperialist powers for encouraging Japan's aggressive attitude toward the Soviet Union. Einstein refused to attend or support its manifesto. "Because of the glorification of Soviet Russia it includes, I cannot bring myself to sign it," he said. He had come to some somber conclusions about Russia, he added. "At the top there appears to be a personal struggle in which the foulest means are used by power-hungry individuals acting from purely selfish motives. At the bottom there seems to be complete suppression of the individual and freedom of speech. One wonders whether life is worth living under such conditions." Perversely, when the FBI later compiled a secret dossier on Einstein during the Red Scare of the 1950s, one piece of evidence cited against him was that he had supported rather than rejected the invitation to be active in this World Congress. One of Einstein's friends at the time was Isaac Don Levine, a Russian-born American journalist who had been sympathetic to the communists but had turned strongly against Stalin and his brutal regime as a columnist for the Hearst newspapers. Along with other defenders of civil liberties, including ACLU founder Roger Baldwin and Bertrand Russell, Einstein supported the publication of Levine's exposé of Stalinist horrors, Letters from Russian Prisons. He even provided an essay, written in longhand, in which he denounced the regime of frightfulness in Russia. Einstein also read Levine's subsequent biography of Stalin, a fiercely critical exposé of the dictator's brutalities, and called it profound. He saw in it a clear lesson about tyrannical regimes on both the left and the right. "Violence breeds violence," he wrote Levine in a letter of praise. "Liberty is the necessary foundation for the development of all true values." Eventually, however, Einstein began to break with Levine. Like many former communists who swung over to the anti-communist cause, Levine had the zeal of a convert and an intensity that made it hard for him to appreciate any of the middle shades of the spectrum. Einstein, on the other hand, was too willing to accept, Levine felt, some aspects of Soviet repression as being an unfortunate byproduct of revolutionary change. There were indeed many aspects of Russia that Einstein admired, including what he saw as its attempt to eliminate class distinctions and economic hierarchies. "I regard class differences as contrary to justice," he wrote in a personal statement of his credo. "I also consider that plain living is good for everybody, physically and mentally." These sentiments led Einstein to be critical of what he saw as the excessive consumption and disparities of wealth in America. As a result, he enlisted in a variety of racial and social justice movements. He took up, for example, the cause of the Scottsboro Boys, a group of young black men who were convicted of a gang rape in Alabama after a controversial trial, and of Tom Mooney, a labor activist imprisoned for murder in California. At Caltech, Millikan was upset with Einstein's activism and wrote him to say so. Einstein responded diplomatically. "It cannot be my affair," he agreed, "to insist in a matter that concerns only the citizens of your country." Millikan thought Einstein naive in his politics, as did many people. To some extent he was, but it should be remembered that his qualms about the convictions of the Scottsboro Boys and Mooney proved justified, and his advocacy of racial and social justice turned out to be on the right side of history. Despite his association with the Zionist cause, Einstein's sympathies extended to the Arabs, who were being displaced by the influx of Jews into what would eventually be Israel. His message was a prophetic one. "Should we be unable to find a way to honest cooperation and honest pacts with the Arabs," he wrote Weizmann in 1929, "then we have learned absolutely nothing during our 2,000 years of suffering." He proposed, both to Weizmann and in an open letter to an Arab, that a privy council of 4 Jews and 4 Arabs, all independent-minded, be set up to resolve any disputes. "The 2 great Semitic peoples," he said, "have a great common future. If the Jews do not assure that both sides lived in harmony," he warned friends in the Zionist movement, "the struggle would haunt them in decades to come." Once again, he was labeled naive. The Einstein-Freud Exchange. when a group known as the Institute for Intellectual Cooperation invited him in 1932 to exchange letters with a thinker of his choice on issues relating to war and politics, Einstein picked as his correspondent Sigmund Freud, the era's other great intellectual and pacifist icon. Einstein began by proposing an idea that he had been refining over the years. The elimination of war, he said, required nations to surrender some of their sovereignty to a supranational organization competent to render verdicts of incontestable authority and enforce absolute submission to the execution of its verdicts. In other words, some international authority more powerful than the League of Nations must be created. Ever since he was a teenager, rankling at German militarism, Einstein had been repulsed by nationalism. One of the fundamental postulates of his political view, which would remain invariant even after Hitler's rise made him waver on the principles of pacifism, was his support for an international or supranational entity that would transcend the chaos of national sovereignty by imposing the resolution of disputes. The quest of international security, he wrote Freud, involves the unconditional surrender by every nation, in a certain measure, of its liberty of action, its sovereignty, that is to say, and it is clear that no other road can lead to such security. Years later, Einstein would become even more committed to this approach as a way to transcend the military dangers of the atomic age that he helped to spawn. Einstein ended by posing a question to the expert in the lore of human instincts. Because humans have within them a lust for hatred and destruction, leaders can manipulate it to stir up militaristic passions. Is it possible, Einstein asked, to control man's mental evolution so as to make him secure against the psychosis of hate and destructiveness? In a complex and convoluted response, Freud was bleak. "You surmise that man has in him an active instinct for hatred and destruction," he wrote. "I entirely agree." Psychoanalysts have come to the conclusion that two types of human instincts were woven together. Those that conserve and unify, which we call erotic, and secondly, the instincts to destroy and kill, which we assimilate as the aggressive or destructive instincts. Freud cautioned against labeling the first good and the second evil. Each of these instincts is every whit as indispensable as its opposite, and all the phenomena of life derive from their activity, whether they work in concert or in opposition. Freud thus came to a pessimistic conclusion. The upshot of these observations is that there is no likelihood of our being able to suppress humanity's aggressive tendencies. In some happy corners of the earth, they say, where nature brings forth abundantly whatever man desires, there flourish races whose lives go gently by, unknowing of aggression or constraint. This I can hardly credit. I would like further details about these happy folk. The Bolshevists, too, aspire to do away with human aggressiveness by ensuring the satisfaction of material needs and enforcing equality between man and man. To me, this hope seems vain. Meanwhile, they busily perfect their armaments. Freud was not pleased with the exchange, and he joked that he doubted it would win either of them the Nobel Peace Prize. In any event, by the time it was ready for publication in 1933, Hitler had come to power. Thus, the topic was suddenly moot, and only a few thousand copies were printed. Einstein, like a good scientist, was by then revising his theories based on new facts. Chapter 17. Einstein's God. One evening in Berlin, Einstein and his wife were at a dinner party when a guest expressed a belief in astrology. Einstein ridiculed the notion as pure superstition. Another guest stepped in and similarly disparaged religion. Belief in God, he insisted, was likewise a superstition. At this point, the host tried to silence him by invoking the fact that even Einstein harbored religious beliefs. "It isn't possible," the skeptical guest said, turning to Einstein to ask if he was, in fact, religious. "Yes, you can call it that," Einstein replied calmly. "Try and penetrate with our limited means the secrets of nature, and you will find that behind all the discernible laws and connections there remains something subtle, intangible, and inexplicable. Veneration for this force beyond anything that we can comprehend is my religion. To that extent I am, in fact, religious." As a child, Einstein had gone through an ecstatic religious phase, then rebelled against it. For the next 3 decades, he tended not to pronounce much on the topic. But around the time he turned 50, he began to articulate more clearly, in various essays, interviews, and letters, his deepening appreciation of his Jewish heritage, and somewhat separately, his belief in God, albeit a rather impersonal, deistic concept of God. There were probably many reasons for this, in addition to the natural propensity toward reflections about the eternal that can occur at age 50. The kinship he felt with fellow Jews due to their continued oppression reawakened some of his religious sentiments. But mainly, his beliefs seemed to arise from the sense of awe and transcendent order that he discovered through his scientific work. Whether embracing the beauty of his gravitational field equations or rejecting the uncertainty in quantum mechanics, he displayed a profound faith in the orderliness of the universe. This served as a basis for his scientific outlook, and also his religious outlook. "The highest satisfaction of a scientific person," he wrote in 1929, "is to come to the realization that God himself could not have arranged these connections any other way than that which does exist, any more than it would have been in his power to make 4 a prime number." For Einstein, as for most people, a belief in something larger than himself became a defining sentiment. It produced in him an admixture of confidence and humility that was leavened by a sweet simplicity. Given his proclivity toward being self-centered, these were welcome graces. Along with his humor and self-awareness, they helped him to avoid the pretense and pomposity that could have afflicted the most famous mind in the world. His religious feelings of awe and humility also informed his sense of social justice. It impelled him to cringe at trappings of hierarchy or class distinction, to eschew excess consumption and materialism, and to dedicate himself to efforts on behalf of refugees and the oppressed. Shortly after his 50th birthday, Einstein gave a remarkable interview in which he was more revealing than he had ever been about his religious thinking. It was with a pompous but ingratiating poet and propagandist named George Sylvester Viereck, who had been born in Germany, moved to America as a child, and then spent his life writing gaudily erotic poetry, interviewing great men, and expressing his complex love for his fatherland. Having bagged interviews with people ranging from Freud to Hitler to the Kaiser, which he would eventually publish as a book called Glimpses of the Great, he was able to secure an appointment to talk to Einstein in his Berlin apartment. There, Elsa served raspberry juice and fruit salad. Then the two men went up to Einstein's hermitage study. For reasons that are not quite clear, Einstein assumed Viereck was Jewish. In fact, Viereck proudly traced his lineage to the family of the Kaiser, and he would later become a Nazi sympathizer who was jailed in America during World War II for being a German propagandist. Viereck began by asking Einstein whether he considered himself a German or a Jew. "It's possible to be both," replied Einstein. "Nationalism is an infantile disease, the measles of mankind." "Should Jews try to assimilate? We Jews have been too eager to sacrifice our idiosyncrasies in order to conform." "To what extent are you influenced by Christianity?" "As a child, I received instruction, both in the Bible and in the Talmud. I am a Jew, but I am enthralled by the luminous figure of the Nazarene." "You accept the historical existence of Jesus?" "Unquestionably. No one can read the Gospels without feeling the actual presence of Jesus. His personality pulsates in every word. No myth is filled with such life." "Do you believe in God?" "I'm not an atheist. The problem involved is too vast for our limited minds. We are in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It does not know how. It does not understand the languages in which they are written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God. We see the universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws, but only dimly understand these laws." "Is this a Jewish concept of God?" "I am a determinist. I do not believe in free will. Jews believe in free will. They believe that man shapes his own life. I reject that doctrine. In that respect, I am not a Jew." "Is this Spinoza's God?" I am fascinated by Spinoza's pantheism, but I admire even more his contribution to modern thought because he is the first philosopher to deal with the soul and body as one and not two separate things. How did he get his ideas? I'm enough of an artist to draw freely on my imagination. Imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world. Do you believe in immortality? No, and one life is enough for me. Einstein tried to express these feelings clearly, both for himself and all of those who wanted a simple answer from him about his faith. So in the summer of 1930, amid his sailing and ruminations in Caput, he composed a credo, What I Believe. It concluded with an explanation of what he meant when he called himself religious. The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion that stands at the cradle of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand rapt in awe, is as good as dead, a snuffed-out candle. To sense that behind anything that can be experienced, there is something that our minds cannot grasp, whose beauty and sublimity reaches us only indirectly. This is religiousness. In this sense, and in this sense only, I am a devoutly religious man. People found it evocative, even inspiring, and it was reprinted repeatedly in a variety of translations. But not surprisingly, it did not satisfy those who wanted a simple, direct answer to the question of whether he believed in God. As a result, getting Einstein to answer that question concisely replaced the earlier frenzy of trying to get him to give a one-sentence explanation of relativity. A Colorado banker wrote that he had already gotten responses from 24 Nobel Prize winners to the question of whether they believed in God, and he asked Einstein to reply as well. I cannot conceive of a personal God who would directly influence the actions of individuals or would sit in judgment on creatures of his own creation, Einstein scribbled on the letter. My religiosity consists of a humble admiration of the infinitely superior spirit that reveals itself in the little that we can comprehend about the knowable world. That deeply emotional conviction of the presence of a superior reasoning power, which is revealed in the incomprehensible universe, forms my idea of God. A little girl in the sixth grade of a Sunday school in New York posed the question in a slightly different form. Do scientists pray? She asked. Einstein took her seriously. Scientific research is based on the idea that everything that takes place is determined by laws of nature, and this holds for the actions of people, he explained. For this reason, a scientist will hardly be inclined to believe that events could be influenced by a prayer, i.e., by a wish addressed to a supernatural being. That did not mean, however, there was no Almighty, no spirit larger than ourselves. As he went on to explain to the young girl, everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humble. In this way, the pursuit of science leads to a religious feeling of a special sort, which is indeed quite different from the religiosity of someone more naive. For some, only a clear belief in a personal God who controls our daily lives qualified as a satisfactory answer. And Einstein's ideas about an impersonal cosmic spirit, as well as his theories of relativity, deserved to be labeled for what they were. I very seriously doubt that Einstein himself really knows what he is driving at, Boston's Cardinal William Henry O'Connell said. But one thing seemed clear. It was godless. The outcome of this doubt and befogged speculation about time and space is a cloak beneath which hides the ghastly apparition of atheism. This public blast from a cardinal prompted the noted Orthodox Jewish leader in New York, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, to send a very direct telegram. Do you believe in God? Stop. Answer paid. 50 words. Einstein used only about half his allotted number of words. It became the most famous version of an answer he gave often. I believe in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the lawful harmony of all that exists, but not in a God who concerns himself with the fate and the doings of mankind. Einstein's response was not comforting to everyone. Some religious Jews, for example, noted that Spinoza had been excommunicated from the Jewish community of Amsterdam for holding these beliefs, and he had also been condemned by the Catholic Church for good measure. Cardinal O'Connell would have done well had he not attacked the Einstein theory, said one Bronx rabbi. Einstein would have done better had he not proclaimed his non-belief in a God who is concerned with fates and actions of individuals. Both have handed down dicta outside their jurisdiction. Nevertheless, most people were satisfied, whether they fully agreed or not, because they could appreciate what he was saying. The idea of an impersonal God, whose hand is reflected in the glory of creation, but who does not meddle in daily existence, is part of a respectable tradition in both Europe and America. It is to be found in some of Einstein's favorite philosophers, and it generally accords with the religious beliefs of many of America's founders, such as Jefferson and Franklin. Some religious believers dismiss Einstein's frequent invocations of God as a mere figure of speech. So do some non-believers. There are many phrases he used, some of them playful, ranging from Der Herr Gott, the Lord God, to Der Alte, the Old One. But it was not Einstein's style to speak disingenuously in order to appear to conform. In fact, just the opposite. So we should do him the honor of taking him at his word when he insists repeatedly that these oft-used phrases were not merely a semantic way of disguising that he was actually an atheist. Throughout his life, he was consistent in deflecting the charge that he was an atheist. There are people who say there is no God, he told a friend, but what makes me really angry is that they quote me for support of such views. Unlike Sigmund Freud or Bertrand Russell or George Bernard Shaw, Einstein never felt the urge to denigrate those who believe in God. Instead, he tended to denigrate atheists. What separates me from most so-called atheists is a feeling of utter humility toward the unattainable secrets of the harmony of the cosmos, he explained. In fact, Einstein tended to be more critical of the debunkers, who seemed to lack humility or a sense of awe, than of the faithful. The fanatical atheists, he explained in a letter, are like slaves who are still feeling the weight of their chains which they have thrown off after hard struggle. They are creatures who, in their grudge against traditional religion as the opium of the masses, cannot hear the music of the spheres. Einstein would later engage in an exchange on this topic with a U.S. Navy ensign he had never met. Was it true, the sailor asked, that Einstein had been converted by a Jesuit priest into believing in God? That was absurd, Einstein replied. He went on to say that he considered the belief in a God who was a father-like figure to be the result of childish analogies. Would Einstein permit him, the sailor asked, to quote his reply in his debates against his more religious shipmates? Einstein warned him not to oversimplify. You may call me an agnostic, but I do not share the crusading spirit of the professional atheist, whose fervor is mostly due to a painful act of liberation from the fetters of religious indoctrination received in youth, he explained. I prefer the attitude of humility, corresponding to the weakness of our intellectual understanding of nature and of our own being. How did this religious instinct relate to his science? For Einstein, the beauty of his faith was that it informed and inspired rather than conflicted with his scientific work. The cosmic religious feeling, he said, is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research. Einstein later explained his view of the relationship between science and religion at a conference on that topic at the Union Theological Seminary in New York. The realm of science, he said, was to ascertain what was the case, but not evaluate human thoughts and actions about what should be the case. Religion had the reverse mandate, yet the endeavors worked together at times. Science can be created only by those who are thoroughly imbued with the aspiration toward truth and understanding, he said. This source of feeling, however, springs from the sphere of religion. The talk got front-page news coverage, and his pithy conclusion became famous. The situation may be expressed by an image. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. But there was one religious concept, Einstein went on to say, that science could not accept. A deity who could meddle at whim in the events of his creation or in the lives of his creatures. The main source of the present-day conflicts between the spheres of religion and of science lies in this concept of a personal God, he argued. Scientists aim to uncover the immutable laws that govern reality, and in so doing, they must reject the notion that divine will, or for that matter human will, plays a role that would violate this cosmic causality. This belief in causal determinism, which was inherent in Einstein's scientific outlook, conflicted not only with the concept of a personal God, it was also, at least in Einstein's mind, incompatible with human free will. Although he was a deeply moral man, his belief in strict determinism made it difficult for him to accept the idea of moral choice and individual responsibility that is at the heart of most ethical systems. Jewish as well as Christian theologians have generally believed that people have this free will and are responsible for their actions. They are even free to choose, as happens in the Bible, to defy God's command, despite the fact that this seems to conflict with a belief that God is all-knowing and all-powerful. Einstein, on the other hand, believed, as did Spinoza, that a person's actions were just as determined as that of a billiard ball, planet, or star. Human beings, in their thinking, feeling, and acting, are not free, but are as causally bound as the stars in their motions, Einstein declared in a statement to a Spinoza society in 1932. Human actions are determined beyond their control by both physical and psychological laws, he believed.